Once again, my name is Alistair Bauer. I am the Committee Secretary for the Select Committee on Land and Mineral Resources. As everybody, well, some might and some might not know, the chairperson of the permanent chairperson of the committee, Honorable Sifaku, has been hospitalized and hasn't been present for the last few sessions. So it is left upon me to elect an acting chairperson for the session. So in accordance with NCOP rules 92.1 and 2, 92.1, if the chairperson of a committee or subcommittee is absent or unable to perform the functions of the chairperson, the committee or subcommittee may elect another of his members as acting chairperson unless these rules provide otherwise in a specific case. An acting chairperson, 92.2, an acting chairperson performs the functions and may exercise the powers of the chairperson. So in terms of those rules, I will now put it to the members to propose and second an acting chairperson. Members?
I move the name of Honorable Nita.
I propose it.
For the record, Mr. Singh has... Mr. Singh has... proposed Ms. Nita as chair, and this was seconded by Mrs. Prince. Ms. Nita, you may take the chair. Thank you.
Thank you very much, members, for giving me the responsibility of chairing this meeting. And good afternoon to all the stakeholders that are present, and as well the department. We'll quickly run through the introduction for the members as well as the department. Stakeholders, when they speak, they will first introduce themselves, so that we manage time properly. My name is Zukiswa Mwita. I'm the member of this committee from Eastern Cape. Over to you, ma'am.
Thank you, Acting Chair. I am Ellen Prince. I'm a member of this committee, and I am representing the Western Cape. Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'm Kathy Labiskahni. I'm a member of the committee, and I'm representing the Western Cape.
Good afternoon, all. My name is Omi Singh, member of this committee, representing KwaZulu-Natal.
Afternoon. Mosaweng Nkosi Mlambo from Gauteng, a member of the committee.
Olwe Mawutu. Good afternoon. Kamalam Dung Pelpaik is a member of the committee. Goes.
Over to the department.
Good afternoon, Honorable Chairperson and Honorable Members. My name is Joel Rapela. I'm the Acting Deputy Director General responsible for Mineral Policy and Promotion at DMR. Thanks. I'm here with my colleague who will introduce himself.
Good afternoon. My name is Wusiso Kobese from the DMR.
Are those the only two from the department?
Good afternoon. My name is Tisela Maleke. I'm from DMR.
Over to you.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Kubis Huister. I'm the content advisor of the committee.
Those were the people that were supposed to introduce themselves. Before we start our meeting, let me quickly tender the apologies that I have received. One is from Honorable Julia, and as well from Honorable Sifaku, as it was indicated. They are both not going to be part of the meeting. And I also tender the apology of some of the members that would sneak out. They have other commitments to quickly attend to. so that you don't get shocked when they get out of the door. Without then wasting time, let's then go straight to the business of the day. I am sure everyone is aware that we are in this meeting today of looking at the Mineral and Petroleum Resource Development Amendment Bill, which was rejected by the President due to procedural defects which have to do with a matter of public participation. So now, as the committee, we are busy dealing with what was found to be a flaw in terms of procedure. We will then allow the members that are here from different organizations to present. I am sure everyone does have the agenda of the meeting in front of you. Everyone will present for time allocated will be 30 minutes. I want to leave it to you if you want to use the whole 25 minutes in presenting, and then your 5 minutes you leave it for questions of clarity. I want to caution members, honorable members, that we do not interact with their presentation. We only ask questions of clarity, so that when we leave here, we are clear of what has been presented. Without wasting time, we'll start with auctionate. That is the first person to present. I don't think we have a problem for you sitting there. You can present from there.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Over to you.
Thank you very much, committee, for the opportunity. But while saying thank you very much for the opportunity, we want to say that we are flabbergasted that we are here today to discuss this bill again, a process that has been ongoing for more than 4.5 years. In the first round of this amendment, we as civil society together made a range of contributions to the bill in hearings and in processes between the DMR and the legislature. And so we are kind of flabbergasted that none of the things that civil society and communities have been putting on the table has been forwarded into this process of amendments. In fact, the 56 scurrilous amendments that were included in this bill does not include anywhere the question of communities and civil society. In fact, it reduces further the participation of communities and civil society in the regulations and in the process of regulating the industry. So we are very concerned that this process, which is patently, in our view, unlawful, continues, and that this bill is going to go through the process only to find itself being challenged in courts, which we know the Chamber of Mines is doing. And we welcome them on our side of the fence of not being consulted and not being taken into consideration. But this is the life of communities and civil society of not being heard by our legislatures. And so this process for us is kind of a deja vu. We're constantly putting forward positions and they're constantly being ignored. And that is not, in our view, the work of a responsive legislature. And so we hope that through this process that this committee will see fit to reject this bill in its entirety and to request that the process be started afresh and that communities and civil societies be given due consideration in this process. So having said that, Chairperson, we are concerned that the additional amendments, as I said, does not include the amendments or the contributions that we've made in the past. In order to overcome some of the difficulties that we've experienced in engaging in this legislative process, we have been engaging communities in separate processes. One of the processes has been what we call the People's Mining Charter, where we went around consulted with over 150 communities, a range of civil society organizations, and in 2015 we produced a Berea Declaration. The Berea Declaration basically affirms that democracy is premised on the following: that affected people must determine their own destinies. And what we're seeing in this process is that the destinies of affected persons are being determined by an exclusive group of people who remain faceless, remain nameless. The recent mining charter is a perfect example of how communities continue to be excluded and how their names are being used as part of this notion of radical economic transformation. Yet if one looks at the mining charter, one sees that communities, which is something that we have been asking for many years, have been included in the shareholding part of the charter. Yet if you dig a bit deeper, you realize that communities actually don't control or own that shares. In fact, the minister and his committees, the advisory, the transformation committee that he sets up in this charter, controls and owns that community shares. So in essence, you have it in name but not in practice. So this is for us a perfect reflection of what has been happening in the sector, that we talk about transformation but nothing happens on the ground. In fact, our research has shown that communities around mining companies and corporations and activities are getting poorer. They are not getting richer. They are not seeing the benefits of these activities, and they are becoming increasingly food insecure. They're becoming increasingly poor in terms of being able to go to schools, to go to work, and so forth. And we find that that's a problem. And we think that this legislation and the process that it's been engaged in is a clear example of why that is happening. If people are not heard and if they are not taken into account, then they will not, their interests won't be taken into consideration. We did a survey and we've presented it to you there. The information is there. And in the survey, we found that 88% of respondents in mining-affected communities did not know what the MPRDA was. So here we have a legislation which the people who are most affected by this legislation don't know what the MPRDA is. Furthermore, what is of more concern is that they felt that 79% of the respondents felt that the current legislation, even that they didn't know what it was not fair to them. So people are feeling disenfranchised, they are feeling hard done by, and as a result, the third question in our survey, the majority of the respondents believe that the only way to affect change in the society is through mass action. Now, if our legislatures are not listening to people and they are sending people onto the streets, then I think we need to start questioning ourselves about what is it that we're doing and how do we make a difference. Our proposal is, the first thing is you need to listen and consult with communities. That is not happening. So I'm going to leave it at that point, and I'm going to hand over to my colleagues who are from Makua and Wamua, which is Mining Affected Communities United in Action, and my colleague Sifiso, who are continuing through this process. They just did a survey recently of over 500 people in two communities, and they will be doing ongoing surveys in these communities to test how communities understand the legislation and how they feel affected by it. And we think that is valuable information for the committee to understand how these things are impacting on communities. So,
Thank you, Comrade Chris. thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. It's important that is we should be able to understand how the communities want to be consulted, not just conclude, because as we have done it now, it has created a dependency syndrome. Everything the government does, it doesn't really sort of consult in the right way or involve communities so that whatever the bill talks about reflects what the communities wants to see. But in this case, when it suits the government, they can go to in all the communities and talk to them. They can, when it suits them, and when it's time of voting and so on, government will go to all over the communities and talk to them. But in these consultation processes, when you send things to websites and all the stuff, it makes it difficult for communities because most of the communities live in informal areas. Don't have this way of, they'll hardly get into a website, into internet. So that itself, it make it difficult for the communities that are highly affected by mines to know what is happening. So we say in that it was this consultation process, it was not really good for communities, as the communities are mostly affected. If you look at, you go further and look at the mining charter, it only talks about 8% to the communities that are affected, which is very less. And gives back 14% to the PE, which is that itself is a radical looting. It goes back to the people who are already benefited. So such things need to be sit with communities and consult them in the right way. Know what is it that they want, because there is no way that these communities will accept this bill. Because they don't know what it carries, what is there for them. So you'll obviously get a negative response to them, which is if you involve people and you know what they want, then obviously people will be, you'll lead it, will be able to deal with it. But this bill is not known by the people. It's a very difficult to deal with. And as we speak now, we are facing with the issue of the minister who doesn't understand that is you look at the unemployment rate, which is talk about almost 37% and so on, and people have got ways of trying to make means of making a living out of abandoned mines there. But the government doesn't know, doesn't involve those people to make sure that is, how do the people, I won't talk much about Zamazamas because my colleague will talk. When we talk of Zamazamas, those people are trying to make a living. And the government, before it even comes up with this bill, they should have consulted communities and say, how do you really make a living out of Zamazama, doing this Zamazama? But that doesn't happen. So we say, in short, this bill, to me, it should be scrapped. And we start afresh. Everyone, every stakeholder gets involved in coming up with what will be good for everybody, because the communities are not there and the communities are not recognized. Based on that, we're saying, in short, let's scrap this and start afresh with everybody involved so that you can understand it.
Thank you. Thank you, Vish. Chairperson and the committee, I will touch on the Zamazamas. First and foremost, we have to understand and differentiate between Zamazamas and small-scale artisanal miners. Small-scale artisanal miners are those that have capital and have political backup to start their businesses. But Zamazamas are ex-mine workers who have lost their jobs one way or the other. And the only way out of unemployment, out of poverty, out of desperation that is characterized by millions, and they are able to put a plate of food on their table, is through Zamazama. And we must not make a mistake to regard them as criminals. Zamazamas are mere workers. It's just that it's the system and legislation does not give them hope, after all, to be included. Right now in South Africa, you're looking at around 9 million unemployed people. Yet Zamazamas are working and they're putting food on their table. If you are able to work and earn a living, you are able to bring dignity to the home. And it is government's duty to create employment, if not, and also fight inequality. So last year sometime we called on Zamazamas in a conference in Joburg, where they expressed their exclusion, which is continuous in the legislation process,
to be protected by the legislation and the policies of the country. And if one looks at the preamble of the Mining Charter, if I may quote, it says the systematic marginalization of the majority of South Africans facilitated by the exclusionary policies of the apartheid regime prevented black people as defined herein from owning means of production and from meaningful participation in the mainstream economy. Now the question is the current legislation protecting and removing red tape for Zamazamas? It is not a difficult task. As we speak in the Northern Cape province, we are engaging with government, provincial government, through the Office of the Premier. We are trying by all means to get Zamazamas to be formalized. How are we going to do that? Zamazamas must form cooperatives and apply for mining permits. However, the process is strenuous. It needs a lot of money, and the legislation does not provide any catalytic processes for Zamazamas to be formal. Hence, the only way for them to continue to work is working like they know.
Can I indicate that you are left with 4 minutes in terms of your presentation?
Okay. So, at this present moment, then if we continue with the bill as it is, then it means then we are not addressing the preamble of the of the Mining Charter. So, as long as Zamazamas are not protected, then we are not doing anything. So, we are calling for the decriminalization of the Zamazamas, and they must be regulated. In Kimberley alone, there's like 3,000 mine Zamazamas who are earning between 1 million and 5 million rand. And a lot of money or revenue annually is lost through illegal mining. So the only way to stop that is to formalize Zamazamas and decriminalize them. I thank you.
Thank you very much for the presentation. As we all know that the women are the most affected, we are pleading to our government to have the recognition in their decision-making for the grassroots women who are facing the challenges day in and day out. The consultation of women will be highly appreciated as we feel left out or invisible to our government, and we would like to be involved. Thank you.
Thank you very much. With the few minutes that we have, let me first welcome honorable members that have just joined us. Now we are to ask just question of clarity, maybe for the purpose of them following the discussions of the meeting. They are presenting to us. We are not engaging really their presentation. We just ask questions of clarity so that when we discuss them later, we are sure of what they have said to us. Now I'm allowing you members to interact with what they have presented in terms of questions of clarity. Honorable Queen.
Thank you very much. Just a clarity seeking question about the presenter was saying that people was not aware of the public participation. Where did they got the information? Was in the media? Because he was saying not everyone have access to social media, and therefore I just want to understand. We know what processes were followed, but I just want to know from there. Where did they hear about this?
Any other question? Honorable
Connie? Thank you very much. Apologies for arriving late, but I was misled. I was misinformed about the venue. the chairperson, coming in, I heard the lady that didn't get the name. Saying that she's pleading with us to prioritize women, which is a very good one. But I my question is also a clarity seeking question as to in what way or in what basis do they need to be prioritized on, or how should they be prioritized? Like, I think she needs to be more specific on the things that they need to be prioritized on, because we would or they would be prioritized on some things only to find out that there are others that were left. Thank you very much.
Those are the two questions of clarity. Can I then give over to the presenter?
Oh, thank you. How do we want communities to be consulted? It's very important. And the way it is done now, it's a problematic, this website thing. But however, we work with NGOs, we have coalition with other organizations that have ways of getting information. And those organizations, those are the very serious concern about the way the consultation is going on with the government. So those people have means and ways of getting information and call meetings with those communities that are affected to inform them of the process that are taking place in the government. But in the way of the getting information in website and all that stuff, it becomes a very problematic for communities.
Sorry, can I just say that Mr. Bauer will acknowledge that we became aware of this process through the grapevine. We never saw it in any official media. We weren't contacted by Parliament, even though Makua was the party that wrote to the President after the first round, after the bill was sent to the President, after passed miraculously through the NCOP in like 3 days or something. Makua wrote to the President to object to the lack of public consultation. When we looked again, sometime during beginning of this year, we saw that the process was ongoing. I then wrote to Mr. Bauer and asked him to please inform us and include us in the process. Only that way did we get involved in the process. Secondly, when the hearings were held in the provinces, we attended most of the hearings in the provinces. And besides the fact that the hearings were, we were given very short notice on the actual hearing, some of the provinces, I mean, there was just a disaster. We didn't, I think Northern Cape, we didn't even know where the meeting was. We still don't know where the meeting was. So we found it very difficult to actually engage with the process. When we got to those meetings that were held, we found that on the day of the meeting, there was a thick document on the chair, and communities were expected to understand that document and engage with it meaningfully in that one day, which was an absolute non-starter. So the whole process for us, and we have documented the whole process, we have written about it extensively, and we're happy to share that with the committee, but we find that the whole process of hearings was problematic, to say the least. On the question of women, in our official presentation to the NCOP and to the different legislatures, we actually make the point that this amendment, despite our asking year after year, hearing after hearing, for women and communities to be given more say, women and communities are excluded in this amendment. Now, we say there's no legal basis for excluding women and communities. So for that reason, we are saying that this is problematic, and we're asking that the committee take that into consideration.
Thank you very much. Just to clarify two things. The first one is the issue of public hearings in provinces. NCOP has no powers in terms of how they constitute them. Ours is just to relay information to them that this bill needs further public participation, and then it becomes their responsibility to do so. But in terms of the information we receive from them, all 9 provinces did have a public hearing. The status of them, we may not be well versed how with they. Two, on the issue of communication, all major newspapers in provinces received the notice a notice, sorry, for the public hearings that are at NCOP level. And we further put it on our parliamentary website. So that's how we communicated it. So we're very sorry if you happen to miss the newspaper and also didn't have an access to our parliamentary website. That then concludes your presentation. Thank you very much. You're welcome to stay with us if you still have interest of being part of the meeting. But if you have a major thing rushing for, you are also welcome to excuse yourself. We'll then go to the next one, which is, we said we're taking offshore. Okay. We're taking Yvonne der Kop Land Claim Committee. They have requested that because they are leaving early, because the second one is not available. Now we're giving them the space for the one that is not available. Over to you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Acting Chair. I'm David Ramahan. I'm the chairperson of the Honorable Land Claims Committee for record purposes. Firstly, would like to thank the chairperson and his committee for inviting us to present as a directly affected mining community. We would like actually to state it categorically clear to the committee that previously we have sent our submissions to the Parliament's high-level panel led by the former president, Mr. Kalima Motlanthe, which is its duty was to review certain key legislations that affect South Africans. We will not repeat actually that, but would rather address the committee on issues that affect us on a daily basis and would like to submit our recommendations to the SC. We've got actually 13 recommendations that we'd like to submit, which I think it will not consume a lot of time. One, there is a committee by the name of the Regional Mining Development and Environmental Committee called the RMDEC, which is chaired by the regional manager of the DMR. We recommend that as the directly affected mining community, we have an interest to serve in that committee and we request that we be considered when reviewing this committee's mandate. Two, it is said that it is the prerogative of the mine to appoint the EAP, which is the environmental assessment practitioner, to consult with the affected and the interested parties. We recommend to the committee that before that person or that company could be appointed, an advert be circulated locally to see if there are no interested companies or individuals for the job. Three, as much as the environmental management plan, the EMP, must be submitted to the minister and the DG, we recommend that such a copy must also be available to the directly affected mining communities for perusal. Four, it is our understanding that before a mining company could prospect, Honorable Chair, a prospecting fee ought to be paid to the DMR. We recommend that the certain fee be paid also to the community that owns the land, since such prospecting might affect their plowing fields or their grazing fields, etc. Number five, we want to state it categorically clear that we know that the mines have sterilized most of the land that they have either leased or reserved for mining purposes. We want to recommend that since the mine is not using the whole surface land for mining purposes, we request that certain portion that is not utilized be available to communities for agricultural farming or for residential purposes. Six, we are very much concerned about the open cast mining that damages the environment to the latter and has been deemed the quickest way of looting minerals. We want to recommend that the RMDEC must report to the DMR on a quarterly basis regarding open cast mining and also give environmental progress reports on a quarterly basis. Seven, we also want to recommend that these mining companies must publish what they are paying, whether in rents, dollars, euros, or pounds, because they are not publishing anything so far. Eight, we recommend that artisanal mining, which is the Zamazamas, be legalized, regulated, and incorporated into the MPRDA. Number nine, we recommend that the minister and the SC on land and minerals should encourage, advise communities to apply for licenses, especially for the low-lying minerals like coal, because those particular minerals are just being hijacked by certain companies. Communities are not giving opportunities to apply for licenses. Number 10, we also recommend that an oversight committee or the RMDEC be present when communities sign the notorious mineral lease agreements between communities or traditional councils and the mines to monitor whether there is fairness, there is transparency, and that communities are not taken for a ride in signing of these lease agreements. We've got an example of such an agreement that was signed actually between the Mapopa Mohale and the Lomi. So that particular agreement is a disaster for the community. 11. Last but not least, we recommend that Section 59, Subsection 2, F and G, be amended to 2. Because that particular section talks about 1, representative from members of the community. 12. We are saying that also Section 59I be amended to 3 communities that own the land. I'm talking about the composition of the board of directors by the MPRDA. 13. We also recommend that Section 59, Subsection 3, which deals with the election of the deputy chair, we are saying that the deputy chairperson of that particular board must be elected from E or I. E or I is talking about the NGOs, the community-based organizations, or communities that own the land. That is what we are pleading with you. In conclusion, Honorable Acting Chair, we want to applaud the Minister for considering 8% for the employees in terms of the charter and 8% for communities. But we recommend that from the 14% that is reserved for the triple BEE, at least 4%, it must be given to the local businesses that are directly affected by mining. Because communities actually, businesses that are directly affected by mining, they are not empowered in as far as business is concerned. That is our problem. So you find out actually companies are coming from Pretoria, from Johannesburg, you see, not actually from the affected mining companies, are the ones that are grabbing the whole 14%. So we want to put it actually as a recommendation that this 4% must be reserved for such communities. Lastly, what I would like to say, Honorable Elkins, is that we actually participated to the public hearings that we're convened. But our concern is that we're only giving actually the bill on the day of the hearing. That is the problem. And that particular bill is a thick document. We cannot actually go through that document in one day, you see. And lastly, what we have recommended in that particular hearing in the Northwest Province, we have said it is important that a mining summit to discuss this particular bill must be arranged so that all South Africans must engage meaningfully pertaining this particular bill. Thank you very much. I don't know if from my colleagues there's someone wants to add.
Okay. Yeah. If there are additions from the delegation, you are still within time, you can present.
Thank you, Chair. We went through these recommendations and we are comfortable as the chairperson is presenting them. Thank you.
Now I'm going back to our honourable members. Questions of clarity? Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much, Chair, and apologies for arriving late. We thought the meeting is at Old Assembly, chambers, so we were waiting there. Nonetheless, I would like to check with the presenters that do you think the manner in which we as Parliament are advertising your participation in any way, it might be this bill or any other bill, do you think that the manner in which we are doing it is it conducive for you, especially from my people from the province I come from, which is the Northwest. Is it conducive for you to access the adverts as per regulated by Parliament? And another thing, Chair, I would like to check with them during their interaction with the province in terms of the very same bill. I want to check whether we acknowledge that the bill arrived late. That means the manner in which we publish the bill is unaccessible to our communities, especially in the rural areas where they come from. But do you think the manner in which it was presented to you as the community of Vredenburg, you were able to grasp and understand the content of the document, or it was so difficult or it was so challenging that you were even unable, even if you agree with the 4% and the percentage given in the document that we must share the little though the companies are taking more? Do you think that is conducive for you, or you are fine with the manner in which it has been documented? Thank you. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honorable Mukwili. But there was an indication from the presenter that it was problematic for them because they received the document on the spot. Secondly, the document was very thick. It was difficult to grasp with all the contents of the bill on the day. That one was stated very clearly. So I'm just saving you from some of the questions.
Thank you very much for forgiving me, Acting Chair. Let me go to the second question regarding the percentage. We very much aware that the Act was talking actually about 26% triple BEE. But as you are saying, we are supporting the initiative by the Minister to increase that from 26% to 30%. We know that it is not enough. If you go to Zimbabwe, yeah, the percentage is different. Zimbabwe is talking about 51-49, you see. But here in South Africa, because we want to engage further with these particular mining companies, don't want to scare them, we are saying at least the 30%, it's a starting point for us to engage. But what we are saying is that from the 14% that is given to the triple BEE, we must get the 4% at the locally directly affected mining communities. That is what we are recommending. We must get that, because there's a lot of people that have got businesses actually around their minds, but they are not empowered, you see. That is the problem. And the procurement system of the mine, obviously, it closes actually a lot of people outside. That's hence I'm saying it's only considering companies that are coming around Pretoria or in Johannesburg. Thank you very much.
Thank you. The last clarity seeking question. We have time for it. Over to you, Honorable Member. Volume above.
My clarity seeking question is on the recommendation number 4 for the compensation to the community. That they must not only pay for the land they are mining in, they must also prioritize in hiring people from residing from those communities. They must develop those communities. And I wanted to talk too much on the 4%. It's very less. It's extremely less. It's not. I don't even want us to negotiate it. It must be actually. No, it's a. Yeah. It's a
is their proposal, we don't engage with their proposal.
No, that's where
we
I'm going.
Only do clarity.
It's a clarity seeking question because he said they were talking about 36%, right?
Mm.
That's where I'm going. And then he made an example of Zimbabwe having to have gotten 51-49. So my clarity-seeking question is, do you want to sit only on the 30% because that was the highest number you or percentage you were given? Do you think 36% is where you want to stop? That's as far as you want to engage. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Over to you, sir.
All right. Honorable member, my understanding, as I'm sitting here, is that I know that actually there is a Chamber of Mind actually is concerned about this 30%. When you check actually media and other form of communication, they're very much concerned. And they are also challenging this particular charter, you see. That is the position of Chamber of Mines. And yesterday, while I was busy liaising with my committee members, I understand that hence we have put the recommendation to say that communities must also sit in the board. Because actually, the board, in terms of the current act, it says actually it's government, it's talking about business, talking about labor. And there's a current situation that COSATU is now actually wanting to engage with business. To say that you want to actually object all of them to this particular chart. So we are saying we are in support of this particular charter because it's trying to empower us. That's what we are trying to say. You see, the little bit that we are getting, we know that it's next to nothing, but at least it's something that we are going to achieve. Then we'll move from there. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Can you be excused on our chair because we have to catch a flight?
To all those that are presenting, you are allowed to excuse yourself when you are done. It's up to you to speak.
Honorable Chair Lady, honorable members, the Chamber of Mines firstly thanks you very much for the opportunity to make our submissions to you. We did forward slides, which we understand you and the committee have, so we won't project them if you wouldn't mind just following along the slides. Firstly, who is the Chamber of Mines? I suppose people do know roughly, but it's a voluntary employer association that supports and promotes the South African mining industry. Its members are major companies, junior companies, and four associations that deal with construction materials and alluvial diamonds, you know, stone, sand, clay, and alluvial diamonds. And of course, the Chamber's members contribute in a very large way to the economy. What we'll deal with on the contents page, some constitutional issues, and we are dealing with those really because those are the reason why the committee is here. President Zuma identified two substantive constitutional issues and the Chamber would like to address those. Then we'll deal with some other key issues and finally with the table of amendments that has been put forward. So turning firstly to constitutional issues, the President, you'll recall, had two substantive reservations, not the procedural ones about no hearings and so on, the ones in substance. Firstly, the proposed inclusion of the Code of Good Practice, the Housing and Living Conditions Standard and the Mining Charter into the definition of this Act in Section 1 of the Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act. And then secondly, the topic of beneficiation, as contravening South Africa's foreign trade agreements. So those were the two, and those we'll address. The National Assembly disagrees with the President's constitutional reservations and says that the Assembly doesn't think the President is right. But the Chamber, in fact, supports the President in his reservations. The Chamber has obtained opinions from its senior counsel, Loxton SC and Unterhalter SC, which indicate that the President's reservations are justified. And of course the problem with not giving effect to them is that if the bill is now passed without those issues being addressed, then the President's remedy would be to apply to the Constitutional Court for a declaratory order on constitutionality, and that would have further delays which are not in the interests of certainty and investment. So turning then on the next slide to this Act and related issues, I've just set out there the various provisions. Firstly, the definition of this Act to include the Code, the Standard and the Charter. Then the addition to Section 25, whereby a mining right holder must comply with those instruments of the Charter. Section 47, in terms of which the Minister is empowered to suspend or cancel a right on contravention of the Charter and the standards, that the Housing and Living Conditions Standards. And then Section 100, which firstly requires the Minister to impose the Standards, Code and Charter as conditions of rights, and also to empower the Minister to amend and repeal those instruments, the Standard, Code and Charter. Now, on the next page, the Chamber submissions about that. The problem, as identified by the President in his first reservation, was that the inclusion of those instruments in the definition transforms those instruments into parliamentary legislation, which is really demonstrated now by the gazetted review charter, which, if this definition is changed, would elevate the charter to being parliamentary legislation, notwithstanding that Parliament hasn't passed it and hasn't even had insight or oversight, rather, into it. That offends the separation of powers between the legislature, Parliament, and the executive, being the minister, and has various effects. Firstly, it means that the minister could make, amend, or repeal parliamentary legislation, because what he does is now defined as being part of the Act itself. But Parliament can't delegate its function to make plenary legislation. It can delegate powers to make subordinate legislation, but this is not subordinate legislation, it's just policy. And that was what the Western Cape case that I've mentioned here, the West Cape legislature case of 95, held, that Parliament cannot abrogate its responsibility in regard to making plenary legislation. The second effect is that these instruments are not designed to be legislation. They're not drafted in the way that legislation is drafted. They give rise to uncertainty and ambiguities, which therefore is contrary to the rule of law requirement in Section 1C of the Constitution. And that was the topic of the Akani versus Pinnacle Point case that I've mentioned there, where the Supreme Court of Appeal said that one shouldn't elevate policy to the level of legislation. And then the third effect is that punitive provisions, the offences and penalties in the Act, would apply to contravention of these instruments without Parliament having any control of what those instruments actually provide. So Parliament would be giving a blank check to the executive, to the minister, in regard to instruments which have yet to be determined in the future by the minister. So the result of all of that is that the Chamber respectfully requests the committee to recommend that those clauses be deleted. The next page deals with the President's second topic of beneficiation and related issues, and the proposals there are really in Section 26, whereby producers of designated minerals are obliged to offer to local beneficiators a prescribed percentage of production in prescribed quantities, qualities, and timelines at what's called or defined as mine gate price, which is really the price at the gate less transport and loading, which means, in other words, not export price, local price. And secondly, the second proposal is that no exports of such designated minerals may occur without ministerial approval, other than those which have been offered for to local beneficiators. The Chamber submissions are twofold in that regard, the first issue being the differential between the mine gate price and the export price that the producer could earn for itself. So the producer will suffer a loss between the export price, which obviously is higher, and the mine gate price, which is obviously lower, and thereby is forced to subsidize local beneficiation. Well, there are a few results of that. Firstly, it's an expropriation of part of the producer's income, which is an expropriation within the meaning of Section 25 of our Constitution. The income is property because mining rights are limited real rights in property. And although there isn't a direct acquisition by the state, the court in the Agri-South Africa case was astute to say there doesn't have to be in each case a direct acquisition by the state. It depends on the circumstances. And here the circumstances are that this provision is in furtherance of the state's economic policies. So that possibly a lower standard of acquisition is required. Now, that being so, the state would have to compensate the producer for that loss of income, because if it's an expropriation, then the Constitution requires payment of compensation. So the state would in any event ultimately pay for the subsidization of local beneficiators. Secondly, of course, a second source of claims for compensation are the bilateral investment treaties which South Africa signed with various countries. South Africa has now withdrawn from those, but all of them provide in one way or the other that investments which were made during the currency of the treaty are still protected for up to as much as 20 years in some cases. So there will be claims for compensation under those treaties as well, which contain broad definitions of what investment is and what expropriation is. And then thirdly, of course, all of this is a deterrent to investment, because if you know you can't earn export parity pricing, well then you're not that, you would be less likely to invest. The second issue arising from the beneficiation provisions is the second issue raised by President Zuma in his constitutional reservations, namely inconsistency with South Africa's international trade obligations, which you'll see is a constitutional issue, not just a matter of enforcement of the trade agreements. The provisions would restrict the quantity of minerals which are available for export, or what's called a quantitative restriction on exports, which South Africa can't do in terms of its international trade agreements. Now that's recognized in the Constitution in various sections. 233 of the Constitution recognizes international law in interpreting legislation and in determining the legality of subordinate legislation such as the minister's prescriptions and regulations. Section 7 and 39 have been held to mean that the state's obligation to give effect to the Bill of Rights requires consideration and implementation of international law, firstly by the minister in tabling a bill, and secondly, of course, by Parliament, including the NCOP, of course, in enacting legislation. And those are these cases that I mentioned there, the Progress Office Machines case and the Glenister case. Well, the effects of all of that, firstly, Parliament in enacting these proposed provisions would violate South Africa's international law obligations, since the only way that the minister could implement them would be by contravening South Africa's foreign trade agreement. He would prescribe quantities that have to be offered for local beneficiation. In doing so, that would be a quantitative restriction which contravenes what the foreign trade agreements require. The President mentioned two of the agreements which we've listed on the slide, the GATT of 94, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs, and then the European Union Agreement on Trade, Development and Cooperation. But in fact, there are rather a lot more, you'll see, which are listed on the slide and, of course, also in our written submissions. As well as that, again, the bilateral investment treaties would be contravened because they contain what's called fair and equitable treatment clauses, which require fair and equitable treatment of foreign investors, and that their legitimate expectations be fulfilled, being that they can export the minerals and realize an export parity price. And of course, thirdly, producers would have to breach their long-term contracts because now they wouldn't have enough production to export in accordance with their arrangements. So the conclusion from all of that is that the proposals entail restrictions on quantities of exports, and then over the page, that the proposals breach South Africa's international trade law obligations, and that South Africa's international law obligations are of constitutional relevance. So it's not just a matter of being sued by somebody in a foreign country. They're of constitutional relevance to us in interpreting legislation, in the minister exercising subordinate powers, in prescribing quantities and so on, and of course in Parliament, including the NCOP, actually making legislation such as the provisions in the bill that we are discussing. So the Chamber's request in regard to all of that is that these clauses be deleted from the bill. Again, if they aren't, the President may well refer the matter to the Constitutional Court, which would cause further delay in passing and implementing the rest of the bill. Madam Chair, the other key issues on the next slide, called B, other key issues. The Chamber doesn't want to dwell on all the issues that it raised in 2013. It wants to mention a few things with which it agrees, with a few suggestions here and there. The first one is the invitation for applications in Section 9, the first come, first served principle, whereby a first application must be processed to finality. The bill proposes to repeal that and impose a ministerial system of invitation, so you can't just apply. The minister would have to open an area, throw it open for invitations. The Chamber at the time submitted that the application system should be retained in parallel with the ministerial invitation system, so a dual system, and that has in fact come through, as we will see in the table of amendments which have been proposed, and certainly the Chamber does propose retention of the dual system also of applications, but it also suggests that Section 9.5, which currently appears in the bill, the new Section 9.5, which gives preference to an applicant, be retained. In the table it suggests to be deleted, the reason being that the Section 16 and 22.9 in any event say you can only have one application at a time, but of course that wouldn't operate in the face of ministerial invitations. So the Chamber requests the reinstatement of the proposed Section 9.5 in the bill. Then very briefly, the Chamber agrees with the proposals in regard to transfers of parts of rights. That's very handy. It's done in a certain way. It also agrees with the provision for extended areas whereby you can add an area to your existing area. There's a limitation generally that the added area can't exceed the new area, but that limitation does not apply in regard to consolidated areas. Were you adding one area to another area for purposes of achieving a consolidation because you want to have the whole area regarded as one for purposes of continuous mining? And that's now in the bill, and the Chamber supports that. There's also a provision regarding associated minerals, a long lacking provision in the MPRDA, which is now proposed in the bill, that there is facility for mining, declaring and then adding associated minerals, such as if you're mining platinum, you can't but, well, you must of necessity mine chrome with the platinum because the two are found in the same seam. Maybe your mining right only relates to platinum and you want to add chrome. There is now a facility for doing that, provided always, of course, that somebody else hasn't already got the mining right for the chrome. Over the page, the environmental legislation tackled in the bill, the Chamber agrees with the provisions there because basically they reflect the move that has already happened, the migration of environmental regulation insofar as it relates to mining from the MPRDA into the National Environmental Management Act, although under the helmsmanship of the Minister of Mineral Resources. The Chamber agrees with that. The only point that the Chamber additionally would like to make is that the transitional provisions need to be further aligned with the now very detailed transitional provisions which appear in the National Environmental Management Laws Amendment Bill of this year, B14 of 2017, which caters for the fact that approvals of EMPs under the MPRDA, which were for done because the application was pending on the 8th of December 2014, when these changes happened, those approved EMPs are not recognized. I think they're intended to be recognized, but the wording doesn't recognize them because Section 38B only recognizes EMPs approved prior to 8th December 2014. It does recognize pending applications. When those are granted, they're actually not, obviously they're granted after 8th December 2014, so that there's a gap which is filled in the NEMA suggested transitional provision. That gap should also be filled in Section 38B of the MPRDA. Historic residue stockpiles, for the first time those have come into the bill. There have been three cases, De Beers versus Attaqua, the Bosolete case, and the Acapa versus Siakui case, which have said that old residues, mine residues produced before the MPRDA are not covered by the MPRDA. The MPRDA amendment added historic, but it still didn't get the wording right. But now in the bill, there is a provision to sweep up these old tailings residues, that ownership of them, common law ownership, is recognized for 2 years, and if they are within the mining area of a holder, the holder can add them to the mining work program applicable to the mine, which of course makes a lot of sense because they are part of the mine. And if they're outside of the mining area, then the relevant owner has 2 years to apply for a mining right or a mining permit. And if he doesn't do so, and bear in mind some of these people are long gone, if the owner doesn't do so, then the residues fall within the custodianship of the state and the ministry is free to grant applications to any applicant. So on these key issues in B, the respectful request of the Chamber is the retention and enactment of these clauses that we've mentioned above, subject to the little suggestions that we've made on Section 9 on invitations for applications and the environmental 38B. Part C is the table of other proposed amendments, which you have, I understand, the table drawn up by the department, although at the behest of some of the commentators. The amendments in the table, just to deal with a few items, firstly, effective date, the definition of effective date. The proposal is that, following the Mawetse case, which held that the a right commences when the applicant is informed of the grant of the right rather than on notary execution, the table proposes a specific period after the right has been granted for the notarial execution to occur. The Chamber's suggestion goes a bit further than that, really to put Humpty Dumpty back on the wall by saying, well, really the better way would be if the right commences not on the date of grant of the application, but rather on date of notarial execution of the right, because that's when the environmental authorization is issued and so on. So that would be the Chamber's suggestion to really overcome the judgment in Mawetse. And you'll see in the written submissions we've proposed some wording, it's easy wording, to the definition of the Effective Act to deal with that. And just to stress here, the Chamber does support this and insofar necessary, in fact, proposes this amendment as recorded in the table of amendments. In over the page, we've already dealt with the dual invitation and application system in Section 9 with the proposed retention of the Chamber's request that Section 9.5 preference be retained. Again, the Chamber actually tables this as a proposal by it as set forth in the table of amendments, subject, however, to the retention of Section 9.5. Over the page, Section 17.2b on concentration, there is a provision that the Minister must refuse a prospecting right application if the grant would result in a concentration of mineral resources in the hands of the applicant. The table proposes to delete that. The Chamber goes further and suggests that deletion also happen where the same concept of concentration is mentioned in Section 33 in relation to retention permits, and again the Chamber therefore proposes this as an amendment. We've already talked about Section 25, whereby a mining right holder must comply with the charter. The proposal in the table is now that the mining right holder must also comply with the housing and living completion standards. As mentioned in the constitutionality part A earlier, the Chamber submits that that's unconstitutional and therefore should be deleted. So it does not agree with that proposal. And furthermore would say that the introduction of that proposal here at this very late stage in the NCOP is not in accordance with parliamentary procedure, and for that reason too it should be rejected. Over the page, mining permits. Now mining permits are a new feature in the table of amendments. They weren't dealt with in the bill at all, they've appeared in this new table of amendments, which proposes that mining permits be reserved for black-owned and controlled companies. Now, the Chamber has members, whether black or white, all races, I mean, the racial issue is not relevant to this. Chamber members need mining permits for small operations. We mentioned that they have associations which are in the realms of stone and sand and clay and alluvial diamonds. Those people operate on a small scale where mining permits can be granted where the operation can be conducted within 3 years and on less than 5 hectares. And it has Chamber members who, as we speak, are actually operating and doing this. So really it would be very difficult then suddenly to find that these permits are only available for black-owned or controlled companies. The Chamber suggests that in any event this is looked after in the Charter, where the target is now 30%, was 26%, and that should be the empowerment target also for mining permits. It submits that the proposal is unconstitutional because it contravenes the right to equality in Section 9 of the Constitution and goes further than permissible redress. It's really reservation of quite an extreme kind. It's contrary to the right of freedom of trade in Section 22 of the Constitution. And again, the late introduction of this, which is not in the bill at all and doesn't relate to anything in the bill, contravenes parliamentary procedure. It's not open to the minister to introduce this at this stage, particularly where nobody else has raised this. And of course the question is, well, what if no black-owned company is interested in the particular deposit? That would in fact sterilize the deposit, which is contrary to the object in Section 2E of the MPRDA of mineral development. And then one wonders why the restriction to companies, why not natural persons if one is going to do this. Over the page then, and these are the last two little things, Section 47, the proposed belated amendment that contravention of the code standards and charter would empower the minister to suspend or cancel rights. Again, the Chamber requests the deletion of that, firstly for unconstitutionality, because it again hangs together with what we talked about in Part A on constitutionality, and secondly again because of unconstitutional parliamentary procedure, because this is not a feature in the bill, it's just arrived somehow. And then the last point is a very technical point about the mining charter being mentioned in relation to petroleum exploration rights. Madam Chair, Honourable Members, a very quick overview. I hope I've more or less stuck to the time. It's quite technical. We would respectfully request you to have regard to the written submissions, because this is quite legally technical, and the written submissions explain it in much greater detail.
Thank you very much. Now I will ask the honourable members if they do have questions of clarity, and consider the fact that it was only 4 minutes. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Chair. A question of clarity on the dual system, the other key issues. You said that Section 9, dual system, ministerial invitations and retention of voluntary applications. Can you just give me a little bit of more explanation of how would the dual system make the applications better? Or what would be the impact of having a dual system?
Any other questions? Mine would be on the issue of related issues of the Act. When you were finalizing your presentation on this one, you said the above should be deleted. So what I would like to know, were you referring to the acts that are listed above, where you have your 25, 47, 103 and 104? So were you referring to those? Thank you very much. Then over to you, sir.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair. The first question on the dual system, in fact it's not really something new. It was just contained in a different place. The minister did always have the power to invite invitations. That used to be contained, as I recall, in Section 16 and Section 22. It was so moving it here, and it's currently, I think, moved further back to, I think, Section 49 of the Act currently. The idea here was to repeal the voluntary application system altogether because the department was being inundated with applications, so that all of the ministerial invitation provisions were going to be moved into Section 9. It's not something new. It just facilitates the minister, if the minister has identified an area where he'd like to throw open the area to a tender process, that he could do so. And it's a well-known method in the petroleum industry, where they talk about a licensing round, where the minister throws open an area and then invites applications and by tender, and they've been adjudicated and so on. So that is a facility, but it certainly has always been the case that the Act has allowed voluntary applications, which were then dealt with on a first-come, first-served basis. And of course that is much better, because particularly with the geological facilities available to the mining companies, they can identify some potential area, even if only by doing a paper chase through the geology books, and then they apply for a prospecting right in that area to conduct prospecting. So the two can actually work in parallel. The main thing, though, why we want to retain Section 9.5 is that if somebody does apply, right, his or her application will rank first because of changes that were made to Section 22 and Section 16 already in 2013, that if somebody has already applied, the regional manager may not accept a subsequent application for the same mineral and land. But of course what one doesn't want is somebody applies and then the minister throws open the area for invitation by tenders, and then of course that poor old applicant loses out. So hence our request. So I hope that explains it. And then secondly, the sections, yes indeed, Madam Chair, the sections we referred to are on the page saying this Act and related issues to which you referred, and those are all the sections which relate to this question of elevating executive instruments, the minister's policy instruments, to the level of parliamentary legislation. So it's the definition of this Act, not to repeal the whole definition, it's to accept the proposed amendment to that definition so as also to include the code, the standard and the charter. 25.2a completely, you know, not to be adopted because it's new. 47.1f again completely not to be adopted, and then the same 400 sub 3 and 100 sub 4.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Chair. My question is that I want to check if the Chamber of Mines are agreeing on the suggested 30% that was suggested in the bill, and also the issue of beneficiation by the mining communities. If it comes to a push that the bill will be accepted into law, will you agree that communities that are owning lands where companies are mining, will you agree on them benefiting somehow? Thank you.
That's not a question of clarity, though, at all. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The first question, the 30%, that really flows from the charter, and of course the topic of this committee's deliberations is the bill. So I don't think we are mandated, unfortunately, to comment on issues which arise from the Charter. As you know, the Chamber of Mines did on Monday institute an urgent court interdict against the Charter. So that matter is before the courts. So unfortunately, if that...
I agree with you, sir. That's why I was saying it's not a question of character.
Thank you.
Let us thank you very much, sir. We don't want to engage. Let me caution my members. We don't want to engage with their presentations now. We'll have our own time. Now we're listening to them and clarify ourselves. Please. Can we then take the next presenter, which is South African Institute of Race Relations?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Again, I would like to put on record our appreciation of the opportunity to come today and speak to the Select Committee. And just to give a little background, if I may begin, and I understand also that copies of the PowerPoint presentation which I sent have been made available to honourable members. So I will really just be going through what's on that PowerPoint presentation and perhaps elaborating a little. But just to give a little background on the South African Institute of Race Relations, it's a non-profit organization. It was formed an awfully long time ago in 1929, and its purpose at that point was to oppose racial discrimination and to promote racial goodwill and move as quickly as possible towards non-racial democracy. Its objects now are to deepen and promote our democracy, to help spur on development, and to ensure the protection of human rights. We have effectively become a policy think tank. We produce every year a big, thick book of statistics covering 14 policy areas, and we also increasingly analyze policy in health, education, and so on. We run a bursary program, and our key objective is to try and expand opportunities for the disadvantaged. I'd like to start by just focusing a little bit on the importance of public involvement in the legislative process. There is, of course, the constitutional provision, which I'm sure you're very well familiar with, which says that both the provincial legislatures and the National Council of Provinces must facilitate public involvement in the legislative process. And the Constitutional Court has on various occasions looked at the meaning of this obligation and has used it as a basis on which legislation must be struck down because public consultation was not adequate. And they have given some guidance as to what is required and have said that legislatures must act reasonably and they must give the public a meaningful opportunity to be heard. In addition, when notice is given of opportunities to make submissions or to attend hearings, not only must enough time be allowed, but the content of the notice must also be comprehensive. It must be enough to help build awareness among people as to what the bill proposes, and it must allow people time to study the bill. And it really needs to give them a good idea of what are the ramifications of the bill, because it's very difficult to comment in a vacuum. And I'm afraid I would respectfully argue that the NCOP has not done enough to meet this obligation in relation to this bill, that when submissions were invited earlier this year, the time period allowed was very short. And yet the bill itself is 47 pages long and it's complicated. And you can't begin to make head or tail of it unless you also get hold of the MPRDA. And then you do the process of fitting the two together. And finally, you begin to see where the changes are going to lie and what the new content will be. But in the content, the invitation to submit written submissions or to attend a hearing, it's also important that there should be an adequate description of the bill. But in this case, the description was very short. It was sometimes misleading. It talks about removing ambiguities from the bill, whereas in fact, I think very often the effect of the bill is to increase ambiguities in the law. And often the wording used was difficult to understand, particularly for people, I would think, who haven't studied the legislation for a long time, who don't have a legal background. It needs to be very clearly set out. What was also disturbing to my mind was that the notice gave no indication of the President's reservations about the constitutionality of the bill. And it's not only the two clauses which the President has flagged, there are other clauses which also seem to be inconsistent with the Constitution for reasons which I will go into in a moment. And it was also gave no inkling of the likely economic damage that would result from the bill. Mining is enormously important to our economy. It contributes less to GDP now because other sectors have grown, but it's still hugely important. And there are various provinces where a great deal of provincial output comes from mining. So therefore, people in each of those provinces need very clearly to understand what the negative economic consequences might be. And the notice provided by the NCOP must help give people that kind of understanding before they can comment and meaningfully participate. Then I'd like to talk briefly about this table with the 57 or so further changes. The President's referral mandate does not extend to the Department's table of further proposed amendments, which, as I understand it, was drawn up in November last year. And when the NCOP invited submissions, there was also no reference to this table. I come from Gauteng, so I obviously had a particular interest in the Gauteng hearings. The Gauteng notice gave no indication of the table either. And if they didn't do it, one must presume that other provincial legislatures, like the NCOP, failed to mention that there were all these further pending possible changes. I attended the Gauteng process, and it was indeed fatally flawed. The notice of the hearing that was provided was far too short. The bill was handed out as people came in at the door, so they had no opportunity to study it. The MPRDA itself was not handed out, so even if they could have time to go through all the 47 pages of the bill, you can't make sense of it unless you have the principal act as well. The table was handed out at the door. That means you've got to look at the bill, the MPRDA, and the table to make sense of how they all fit together. And all of this was now supposed to be done by people who arrived at 10 or so in the morning and were dismissed at 1:30. How could they possibly do it? It was a travesty. And the chairman of the portfolio committee in Gauteng, in fact, acknowledged that the public consultation had been grossly inadequate, and he apologized for it. And he said he was sorry that so little had been done to send the bill out in advance, and sorry that only one meeting had been held in a central venue, which made it harder for people further afield to come in. And he said the trouble was the short time period which had been set and which he felt obliged to go along with. Now, presumably, this must have affected other provinces as well, that very short time period. And yet this is the kind of basis on which the Constitutional Court has struck down law in the past. Because, as the judges have put it, you can't have legislative timetables trumping constitutional rights. It's the rights that must take precedence and not the timetable. I'd like to talk briefly about the President's constitutional concerns and to put them really in a very much of a nutshell in a very simple way. As we've heard, President Jacob Zuma decided not to sign the bill into law in January 2015 because he had reservations about two clauses in particular. Excuse me. And the one was that the argument is that it's unconstitutional to make the mining charter a part of the principal statute of the MPRDA and still give the mining minister the power to amend it. That, in a nutshell, is the problem. There are other problems too, how you can elevate something that was never put before Parliament into a part of a statute, but that's the essence of it. You can't make it part of the statute and still allow the minister to amend it because it contradicts the separation of powers. And the President's further constitutional concern was triggered by the power given to the minister to designate certain minerals as needed for beneficiation or local value addition. But these controls contradict international agreements which are binding on South Africa, particularly GATT, the General Agreement on Tariff and Trade, which has been incorporated into South African law. And there are many legal arguments that can be made around this, but in essence, we can just focus on this point, that the minister's export controls will be unlawful in terms of GATT, which is part of our law, and yet the Constitution in Section 33 guarantees everybody the right to do administrative action, which is lawful. So there's clearly a contradiction, and this is an issue of unconstitutionality which needs to be resolved. And I see it, the only way it can be resolved is by removing the parts of the bill that are in conflict with the Constitution. I'm also concerned that there are other clauses which are unconstitutional, mostly because they're not in keeping with the rule of law. and the rule of law is a founding value of our Constitution. The supremacy of the rule of law is something that has to be upheld at all times. It can't just be ignored. And in essence, under the rule of law, legislation must be certain and clear so that people know what is allowed and what is forbidden, and so that everyone is treated the same way, so that you have equality before the law. But many clauses are in the bill are far too vague to satisfy those criteria, and there are often too few guidelines, generally too few guidelines, to help the minister and guide him when he exercises his discretion and makes decisions under the bill. So just to give a few examples, the minister has too much discretion in deciding what minerals should be designated for local beneficiation. What minerals are strategic, he can decide on that as and when the need arises, which is an extremely broad criterion. And what percentage, say, platinum is designated as needed for local beneficiation, what percentage will it be that the mine must make available? Will it be 50%, 75%, 100%? The minister has full discretion to decide. And it seems, though this is not set out in the bill, those minerals that are decided and identified as strategic are probably going to come under price controls. This is what one picks up from the ANC's own policy documents, including the resolutions taken at the Mongolian conference in 2012, when a long list of strategic minerals was included, and the idea was very definitely put forward that these should be subject to both export and price control. But the bill doesn't tell you whether this is what's envisaged. It just gives the minister the power to impose those sorts of control. Then there are other overly vague clauses, and those also deal with environmental issues. It's obviously very important that there should be proper environmental protection, that after mining has finished, there should be a proper closure procedure. My concern is with a provision in the bill which says that a mining company which stopped mining and gets a closure certificate will still be liable for any environmental damage which may become known in the future. And to get a closure certificate, you have to rectify all the known problems that people are aware of at that time. So the mining will have done what it needs to do. It will have rectified the known problems. But some other problem could come up in 50 years' time. After the mine has been closed, it seems that water has been polluted. How can it be decided that the mine was really responsible for that? It's far too vague, and there will be officials who will decide it one way in one case and a different way in another instance, and that too is contrary to the rule of law. It's an element of uncertainty which is impermissible. And then I must just draw attention to this because it seems such an extraordinary provision that a mining company might have to pay a fine of up to 10% of annual turnover. Its directors might face jail for up to 4 years for the following crimes: for failing to promote optimal economic growth and failing to promote the development of downstream beneficiation industries. If you think back to our criteria, the people must be able to know what conduct is allowed and what conduct is prohibited. Clearly, that kind of test is not satisfied when you have such a very vaguely defined offence, and where whether the country grows or not is really not a matter that any single mining company can control. Particularly, it depends on the content of policy, global factors, etc., etc. And so these new offences clearly are inconsistent with the rule of law, and yet the supremacy of the rule of law must always be upheld. And I also want to talk about risks in state-controlled beneficiation. Obviously, beneficiation is a good idea. If we can add value to our minerals here, if we can generate jobs, if we can sell those products at a higher price, there's obviously a value in that. And companies have seen that value, and they do, in fact, quite often beneficiate minerals already. We have companies that refine and smelt and make steel and make oil from coal and so on. So business, when they see the economic opportunity to do it, will go for it. But firms can't easily beneficiate now, and in fact some of the beneficiation which happened in the past has now been reduced because you have to have sufficient electricity, and we've had problems in that regard for a while. You also have to have reasonably cost-effective electricity, but prices have been rising very fast. We also have shortages of skills, and we don't have enough direct investment coming in. and we have high input costs, not only on electricity, also on labor and other factors, and we're increasingly uncompetitive, especially when one thinks of the Chinese manufacturing behemoth and the fact that they can produce steel so much more cheaply than we can. And yet we want to try and compel beneficiation even when it may not make economic sense. The National Development Plan warned about these problems. They said there was a tendency in the ruling party, in the government, to see beneficiation as a tremendous solution for our economic problems. But they said the trouble in essence is we don't have the electricity and we don't have the skills. And the IDC, which already has a mandate to promote beneficiation, has also been saying it's very difficult to achieve in practice because of these factors, because of other things like the volatility of the rand. So we can't actually increase local beneficiation unless we can deal with the underlying problems which are making it so difficult to do right now. But the bill ignores that economic reality. It simply gives the minister the power to say that certain minerals will have to be locally beneficiated in the percentages that he decides. And it may not make economic sense at all. It may be damaging not only for mining companies that have to now sell at a lower than export price, but also by deterring investment by miners and by making the whole business environment seem hostile to the private sector, we can have very many other negative consequences. And another one which really needs careful thought too is that already we have the reality that the bill is choking off investment in new coal mines. At the moment, we still depend 95% for our energy on coal. So it's very important that new coal mines should be open to feed the coal-fired power stations which Eskom is busy building. And Eskom has spoken of $100 billion in new investment being needed. And a little bit is happening, but not nearly enough. And the critical thing is not because we don't have coal in the ground. It's because it's not economically sensible to mine it in these circumstances where the minister can control too much of the sales process. So the coal still in the ground is likely to remain there, and we could get to the point where Eskom has to do load shedding again because nobody wants to mine the coal. Yeah. Already we also know that new exploration for minerals is a quarter of what it was in 2007, and this is an indication of how hostile our mining policy is becoming. Where you have an existing operation, firms will still invest because they need to keep the operation going. But when it comes to something new, they're very wary of coming to South Africa. The major mining companies are looking outside South Africa. Even somebody like Sibanye, which talked about being a local South African champion, is now buying a platinum mine in the US. And people might think, well, it doesn't really matter. If the majors go, we can rely on the small mining companies. But the chances are that they will battle to raise the necessary funds, that they will lack economies of scale, and they will particularly battle with the massive environmental issues. You need big companies with big resources to handle the environmental issues well. And you might also have people say, well, it's fine, we'll use a state mining company, they'll do it better. But the experience around the world shows that state mining companies generally are not as efficient as the private sector. Often they battle to raise money, and that could certainly be a factor here. We already have an economy that's in recession, very high public debt, taxes which are going to be diminishing rather than growing. So how much money will there be for a state mining company to use? How much better would it not be to bring money in from elsewhere in the world to exploit these resources? We also have to have a level of efficiency in the state mining company, and I'm afraid that when one thinks about some of our parastatals, from Eskom through to Prasa and SAA, it's difficult to be confident that a state mining company will be more efficient. Sorry. Then I'd like to just elaborate a little on the economic damage from the bill. Even in the boom years from 2001 to 2008, when Chinese demand was huge, South Africa's mining industry shrank by 1% a year. And that was a finding by the National Development Commission in the NDP. At the same time, there were mining industries in other countries that grew by 5% a year in that boom period. And the NDP describes that as an opportunity lost. And they say a great deal of the reason for it was that South Africa has bad mining law. And they criticized the MPRDA as being too vague and being too uncertain, and they said what we need is reforms, changes to the MPRDA that will make it more predictable, stable, and competitive. But unfortunately, the bill which is before us now will have the opposite effect. In 2015, a former South African mining executive warned that in 20 years' time, South Africa might not have a mining industry at all. And he was looking at that point at the way in which the new investment in exploration is falling off. If there isn't sufficient exploration investment in time, the existing operations will wind down, and there will not be interest in starting up new ones. But the mining industry, though it's smaller than it used to be before, is still enormously important to our economy. And it provides jobs directly and indirectly to 1.5 million people, assuming that each of them supports 10 individuals, it's helping to support some 15 million people in all. Obviously, it adds to our gross domestic product. To export earnings, it helps buttress the value of the rand. And it's particularly crucial in five provinces, four of which are mining provinces, from the Northern Cape, Limpopo, Northwest, and Mpumalanga. Also the Eastern Cape, which doesn't have mining activities, but very much people there depend on the remittances sent home by mine workers elsewhere. There are various mining towns whose fortunes are intricately tied to mining, such as Rustenburg. We have two harbors, at least, that depend for much of their business on mining. We have Eskom, which critically needs the coal to keep its power stations going. We have Transnet, which makes much of its money and employs people on the basis of the minerals it transports around the country. And critically, the mining industry also spends about 245 billion rand on buying goods and services. It's a big amount of money. So that's obviously sustaining any number of other businesses. And again, it's a vital contribution to the overall success of our economy. But the mining industry is already, in fact, in deep trouble. And it's not just because of low commodity prices in recent years. It's very much because of bad laws, as the National Planning Commission warned a number of years ago. The industry lost 50 billion in the period from 2014 to 2016. It lost 65,000 jobs since late in 2015. The latest figure I've seen is that it's now up to 75,000 job losses. And this, imagine, I think, what would happen to the country if we could get the mining sector to grow by 5% a year, which is what other mining countries were able to do. So many more jobs in mining and out of mining. So much more revenue to help boost education and health. So many more contributions to export earnings to sustain the value of the rand. We could be in a very different country if our mining sector was growing by 5% a year. And I think it's very important before a bill with the potential to damage the industry so badly, before Parliament moves ahead with adopting such a measure, to think very carefully about its economic consequences. And it would certainly have helped the process of public consultation if a proper CS assessment, a socio-economic assessment, had been conducted before the bill came back to the public in this latest round. So I would argue that the NCOP must start again because the process of public consultation has been so flawed. This was one of the problems which President Zuma highlighted when he referred the bill back. So there can't be again an inadequate process of public consultation. And what has happened so far has been inadequate. Seems vital, therefore, to stop, go back, and do it properly. And I would argue that this should not be backed by a proper CS assessment so that one can really examine, is this bill the best way of meeting the objectives of the government? Is it really going to help the industry to grow? Is it really going to help to provide opportunities for people? Or is it going to be very negative and damaging from its ramifications? The NCOP process was flawed, as I said, part of the reason why we need to go back. The Gauteng process was undoubtedly flawed, as the chairman of the Portfolio Committee acknowledged, and I would expect that the same happened in other provinces too. The table with these extra 57 or so amendments simply can't be taken on board at this time. Some of those changes might be possible. But they lie outside the referral mandate given to Parliament by the President, and there's been no public consultation on those changes either. People mostly have had no idea that those changes were pending in any way, And when they walked in the door of the public hearings, were given a copy of the table. That is not enough. All the unconstitutional provisions must also be deleted, because as the Constitutional Court has stressed, the Constitution is of course binding on all branches of government, including Parliament, and so there's an obligation on the NCOP to make sure that any legislation which it adopts is fully consistent with the Constitution, not contrary to it. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Now question for clarity. Please stick to clarity, Honourable Cohen. I know you. Thank you very much for the presentation. My question is very, very, very short and straightforward. On your way forward, the last page. The last bullet, you say all unconstitutional provisions must be removed. NCOP has the duty to do so. So I want to check your take on the amendment of the Constitution with regards to the expropriation of land without compensation. Your take. Thank you.
A question of clarification.
I'm not going to allow that question. No. Ma'am, you are not going to respond to that question. It's not right. No. I'm not going to allow that. Honorable Mukwili.
Thank you, ma'am, for your presentation. I need clarity. You know, this thing of clarity is closing us out. But I need clarity on the your presentation is not numbered. Ne? Risk in state-controlled beneficiation. The last bulletin that says state mining company unlike to do better. Can you kindly elaborate, because I want to get it on point, that your take on this matter. Are you saying if the state will control, they will somehow lack or what? Can you elaborate on that, ma'am? Thank you.
Over to you, madam.
Thank you. The bill envisages a state-controlled process in that it enables the minister to identify the minerals which are going to be designated, set the percentages, the quantities, and so on. And I think the concern is, first of all, that many of the major mining companies that are here are increasingly less interested in mining in South Africa. So then would a state mining company be the solution? There might be many people who think that. But if you look at the experience of state mining companies around the world, inevitably they suffer from three problems, in fact. The first is a lack of money. And a lack of money is likely to be a problem here. Because when in mining, it's a very capital-intensive thing. You need lots of money to be able to do it effectively. And we already have debt at 52% of GDP, at close to 70% of GDP if you take into account the contingent liabilities to the SOEs. So we have an economy that's in recession. We have tax revenues unlikely to grow. So we don't have a lot of money to make available to the state mining company to say, here you are, go on and do it. That's the first problem. The second problem is the efficiency issue. And I'm afraid I'm suggesting that we think about the efficiency of some of our state-owned enterprises, about Eskom and the fact that we got plunged into load shedding at various times, that PRASA has bought engines which we're told are too high to fit on the tracks, things like that. When you have the private sector responsible, they go out of business if they make a mistake of that magnitude. But a state-owned company can always be bailed out by taxpayers' money, assuming there is still some of that. And then the third issue is often political control, that when the state mining company is trying to decide what it should do, it will be swayed by what the politicians say, whereas a private mining company would be swayed by the economic considerations, what makes commercial sense. And it's the latter which is much more likely to result in profits, increasing jobs, and overall gains.
My honorable members, you are being armed here by our constituencies.
from different institutions, so that when we finalize the bill, we are able to have information straight from the horse's mouth. Ne? So please relax. You are being armed. I did indicate earlier on the issue of provinces. Seriously, we don't have control. Our responsibility is to give them the bill and tell them exactly what is expected. Practical implementation of that rests with them. But I'm not stopping people that are still going to indicate what happened in their provinces. Because it's also important that we know, so that we're able to do follow-up, because we are from the provinces. Two, on the issue of NCOP, we gave stakeholders 30 days in terms of invite. And even after the 30 days, when submissions were getting in 3 weeks thereafter, we said to the office, take them in, so that we are able to call them and make submissions. So no one was cut off because we had a deadline in terms of the 30 days that was set for ourselves. I think that one I must make it very clear, because I was directly involved in terms of the invitation. We're talking with the office that was doing the work. If you receive it late, it's another thing, but we know exactly the time frame. Yes, we set as a committee, not necessarily as a committee, as a management, we look at the submission. We decided to extend so that even those that have submitted late, their submissions are considered. So no one was like eliminated from the process of public participation, because we took it very seriously.
Based on what you are saying, Chair, I just want to check. My apologies if I am out of order.
Sure.
I really
you know
apologize.
Cut you.
Yes, I know, ma'am, you'll cut me. But I think the stakeholders, Chair, have the right to raise their concern in terms of our consultation process. And us as Parliament, as NCOP, we have our own way of dealing with things, or we have levels where we deal with things. I think we should acknowledge that the process that we are doing, be it writing, be it advertising on social media, whatever source that we are using, we must acknowledge that perhaps it doesn't reach where it should reach. It's a way of us gauging our way, the way we communicate. So we need to, whoever that has that concern, let's register it, and in our deliberation is then that we can see how best can we communicate with our fellow people. I will set an example. I'm from Northwest in the Bojanala region. We have a village called Mokhalwane, where Swartklep mine is. That area is a deep rural area. The manner in which we are doing our invitations, the community might not have access to the system that we are using. That is why some of them are not here. And they didn't even apply to come and make submissions. It's because of the vastness of the area. So we will debate further into that. It must be highlighted and noted. Thanks, Chair.
Thank you very much. You are echoing what I've said exactly. We accept your comments because they are enriching us and they'll make us to further polish how we do things in terms of the feedback that we receive from you. But at the same time, we need to explain to you how we did the process. Thank you. Can we then go to the next speaker, which Weber Venser.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bulani Chabalala Kingston. I'm a partner at a firm called Weber Wenzel Attorneys, representing the firm. Alongside me is Mr. Manus Boyson, who is one of the mining experts at the firm. My responsibility rests with oil and gas regulatory matters. Weber Wenzel, as you might be aware, is one of the leading law firms in South Africa. We've been advising the mining industry for over 100 years, and we have the largest mining on-the-ground team in sub-Saharan Africa, and quite separately, we also have the largest on-the-ground oil and gas team in sub-Saharan Africa. We have been engaging with the bill as a concerned and interested party and corporate citizen. What we are hoping to achieve today is to simply highlight the unintended consequences of the bill from a legal perspective, as we are keen to assist and contribute to the promulgation of the most appropriate legislation in respect of the mining and oil and gas industries in our country. I will speak to four of our general concerns regarding the bill, which will be followed by Mr. Boyson, who will focus on the concerns pertaining to the mining aspects of the bill. I will then finish off with our concerns and suggestions as pertains to oil and gas, Chapter 6 of the bill. In the context of our general concerns, these are fourfold. In the first instance, our concern relates to the vagueness and uncertainty around the bill in general. In this regard, I'll say that the rule of law requires law to be certain, and in addition to that, the Constitutional Court has also made it clear that it would be inappropriate for a minister to exercise unfettered and unguarded discretion in situations fraught with potentially irreversible and prejudicial consequences to business entities and other affected parties. So coming back to the bill, there are numerous instances of the use of vague and uncertain language, which will lead to regulatory uncertainty and allow administrators who are empowered under the bill overly broad discretion. The second general concern relates to... relates to the regulatory regime, and this is a two-part concern. As things stand today, our regulatory regime is one that is license-based, and what the bill proposes or seeks to do is to change this to a concession-based regulatory regime. In essence, what currently happens, as we know, is that whoever applies first for prospecting rights is awarded prospecting rights and subsequent to that a license on predetermined terms and criteria. The concession regime requires that minerals be effectively auctioned to the best prospective concessionaire who meets a minimum set of requirements. The concept of a first-come, first-serve application process is done away with. This system, we believe, will discourage junior mining companies. And in addition to that, we believe that a concession-based regime is best implemented where you have sufficient information regarding mineral deposits that is made available to potential investors. So while South Africa is an advanced mining country, we certainly have limited knowledge of our geology. The third and related issue pertains to the order of processing applications and the introduction of the concession regime that I mentioned earlier. With regard to this point, the amended Section 9 of the MPRDA abolishes the first-come, first-assessed principle, and instead it introduces an invitation system under which the minister must invite applications before applicants may apply for rights to particular minerals and land under the MPRDA. So while any person may request the minister to issue such invitations, it doesn't appear that the minister was required to issue invitations simply because the request is made. In the bill allows anyone to request the minister to issue an invitation, but it is silent on whether the minister is required to issue invitations as a consequence of a request made. The minister is now required to give preference to an application lodged by the person who first lodged the application. The last general point pertains to time periods. There are a significant number of time periods which provide certainty under the current regime, which have now been removed and replaced with a reference to prescribed period to be determined by the minister. In our view, this change of regime is too vague and will lead to great regulatory uncertainty. I'll now allow for Manus to take us through the specific concerns around the bill.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Madam Chairperson and honorable members of the committee. Allow me to just give you a brief background as to why a law firm practicing law in the mining field would come here to Parliament and make their presentations and participate in the legislative process. We are all Parliament, government, the mining industry, and all role players in the industry concerned, and I think we stand in the service of the people of our country. We need to promote economic growth, we need to promote employment, and we need to eradicate poverty. The only way to do that is to promote investment and to increase investment. And the only way that we can do as parliamentarians and as mining lawyers is to create a regulatory framework conducive to investment. And we can do that. It's all within our power and within our means. I will latch on to what Bulani has indicated, the whole system of from a licensing regime to a concession regime and the tender system. That is a major problem area. The second area that I will deal with is beneficiation, of which you've heard quite a significant number of representations. And then I also want to deal with the ministerial consent. And if you will allow me at the end, I will try to make a practical recommendation to the National Council of Provinces, because what I've heard this afternoon is you've heard a lot of comments, criticism, but I think it might be difficult in your own minds as to how are you going to deal with this situation where the President has referred the legislation back to Parliament. So, the mineral concession regime, Polanyi has indicated in principle comments and problems that we've got with that. Prospecting is very important to the growth of our mining industry. People will not be incentivized to prospect if there's not a system which allows that prospector who made a find to develop and progress to a mining right. That is the reward for the risk taken by the prospector. Prospecting is a very high-risk industry. That means that the prospector is going to lose most of his money or all his money most of the time. But if he doesn't lose his money, there must be an opportunity for him to realize some benefit, and that is to get a mining right. The tender system will eliminate that incentive for a prospecting company and for junior companies, as we've heard from the Institute for Race Relations. So that is really a fundamental concern, and I think the NCOP has got the power in its hands. The National Assembly referred the bill to it, and it has got the power to deal with that. I will make a recommendation on how to do that. The next issue is that I want to raise is mineral beneficiation. In terms of the bill, the minister is empowered and has got very wide discretionary powers to designate minerals for local beneficiation, which in itself sounds very laudable, and I agree it is laudable. The difficulty is the minister's powers are too wide, and it will interfere with fundamental economic principles. What the minister is authorized to do is to not only to designate minerals for local beneficiation, but also to publish conditions required to ensure security of supply. That he must do in consultation with another minister for national departments, after taking into account national development imperatives, and after considering the advice of the Ministerial Council. So what the minister is then empowered to do is to prescribe percentages, quantities, qualities, and timelines of which producers and mining companies must now provide to local beneficiaries. Those qualities are going to be problematic because the minister has got the power to prescribe qualities higher than what a mining company produces. So if you produce a 21 CV megajoule per kilogram CV coal, and the minister says, I want 30, then you must produce that, otherwise you're going to lose your mining right. So it's really fundamentally problematic. The price at which that supply must take place is at the mine gate price, which we don't know what it's going to be. It simply says it's defined as the price of the mineral or mineral product at the time that the mineral product leaves the area of the mine and excludes charges such as transport and delivery charges from the mine area to the local beneficiator. The other fundamental problem with the mineral beneficiation proposals is that we are going to create an export licensing system, because the bill says a producer may not export any mineral unless he has satisfied two requirements. He must comply with the minister's determination of local beneficiation supply, and the minister must give his approval. So he's written approval for export. So those export mechanisms are then going to be potentially in contravention of our international trade obligations. The reason being, the General Agreement on Trade and Tariffs provides, to which South Africa is a party, I must emphasize, that no prohibitions or restrictions or export licenses or other measures may be placed on the exploration or sale for export of any product destined for the territory of another contracting party. So this article prohibits World Trade Organization members from imposing quantitative restrictions on exports. There are consequences if you contravene your international trade obligations. The World Trade Organization has got power. But more importantly, Madam Chairperson, is the fact that these contraventions might be an embarrassment for our country in the international community, and particularly in the international mining investment community. Madam Chairperson, Polani, as my colleague Ms. Kingston has dealt with the time period which the bill proposed to be all as prescribed. Timing is a very big problem in the mining industry and the regulatory environment, where it takes inordinate long times to get appeals heard, to get decisions taken, to get approvals granted, all of which hampers our industry. The next topic that I want to address is the whole question of what has been defined as historic tailings, and I'll put that in inverted commas, because I don't think the tailings are of historic significance, but the intention is probably to refer to historical tailings. The principles as embodied in the bill are positive, and we support that. It's all in, the objective is to bring historical tailings within the ambit of the MPRDA. In principle, we have no problem with that. We think it's a good suggestion, and the proposals are good. The difficulty is the terminology used. Two terms are defined. Residue stockpile, the definition is amended to include old tailings. And historic residue stockpile is a new definition, which some dumps may now fall within both those categories. And in the regulatory provisions, none of those terms are used. The term historic residue stock deposit is used. So it's really, from a legal perspective, very confusing. I think it's going to give rise to lots of court cases again. We are being too much regulated by the courts, and I would suggest that attention be given to the detail of those provisions. Madam Chair, the next topic that I want to raise is relate to the amendments to Section 11 of the MPRD Act. Now, Section 11 requires ministerial consent for a number of actions. If you want to transfer a prospecting or a mining right, or if you want to transfer a controlling interest in a company. The amendments go further than that. It requires ministerial consent for the transfer of an interest in a right in an unlisted company. Now, I've been practicing mining law for the last 30 years, if not more, but I don't know what is an interest in a right in an unlisted company. It's two different concepts. It's being confused here. That's the first part. The second part is the minister may then impose conditions for his consent, and unlimited discretion, any condition may be imposed. What we understand, Madam Chair, is the fact that there's a need for ministerial consent, because the minister has got the obligation to make sure that the provisions of the Act are complied with. But the problem is that the minister's discretion is too broad and it's uncertain. What is not certain is whether an interest in a right includes a shareholding, an indirect shareholding in a company. So a shareholding in a holding company, it's not clear whether it's covered by this provision and whether it should be covered. So what I'm saying is, while I understand the need for ministerial consent, we must know exactly when the minister's consent is required, and the consent must be required when it's needed to serve the purpose of the Act and not be go beyond that. The proposed amendment to Section 11 also introduces a very cumbersome procedure. So if you want to transfer a right or a portion of a right, the transferee must now lodge an application for a right. And it's not an application for a new right, it's an application for the minister's consent. The fact that the requirement is there, that the transferee must satisfy the requirements, that's understandable. But it's not necessary to go through the whole process of applying for a right again. I dealt with the issue that the minister's discretion is, as far as conditions for granting consent, is unlimited, totally unlimited. Madam Chair, if you look at our written representations, we've dealt with consultation with interested and affected parties. We haven't got the time now to deal with that in our verbal presentations, but I want you to please take account of that. There are some issues with environmental provisions which we've got problems with. It results in a confusing and apparently irreconcilable overlap in responsibilities between the Minister of Mineral Resources on the one part and the Minister of Environmental Affairs on the other part. Because the Minister of Mineral Resources is the responsible authority for the implementation of environmental provisions of NEMA, and current environmental management plans are considered to be environmental authorizations issued under NEMA. Um, we have a fundamental problem with the issue of closure certificates. The purpose and object of the MPRD Act was to impose the obligation on mining right holders to apply for a closure certificate. The reason being to bring finality on his obligations and for the department to ensure that he's complied with all his obligations before a closure certificate is issued. But once a closure certificate is issued, that former holder must be absolved from further liabilities. The bill proposes to bring in an obligation to apply for a closure certificate, but the effect of that would be, there would actually be no effect, because notwithstanding a closure certificate, the holder will remain liable for any environmental effects of his mining activities. So if you say you must apply for a closure certificate, but the effect thereof is of no consequence, then it's highly unlikely that anybody would apply for a closure certificate. We've made some comments regarding penalties, which I am not going to deal with now. I think the penalties are harsh, but be that as it may, I think it's probably well understood that there must be consequences for non-compliance. Another positive development is the regulation of associated minerals, which is not regulated in the MPRDA. It was regulated under the Minerals Act of 91, and we think that it's important to have associated minerals covered, because if you have a mining right for platinum, it's almost inevitably that you're going to mine chrome as part of it. And the current unregulated position is very undesirable. Madam Chairperson, if I may conclude, the three fundamental issues that we believe are problematic, and it's not going to serve the noble and laudable objectives of the MPRD Act to enhance mineral and petroleum resource development, to promote economic growth, and to promote employment and enhance the social and economic welfare of all South Africans, are the three clause 5 of the bill, the moving from a licensing system to a tender system. We do not believe it's going to be in the best interest of growing our mining industry. We think the contrary. The second thing is clause 8 of the bill, the amendments to clause 9, to section 11, forgive me, the requirements to obtain ministerial consent to transfer a right. And the third one is the clause 21 dealing with section 26, the whole question of beneficiation. Now, my understanding of the constitutional process under circumstances such as these, where the President has referred legislation back to Parliament for consideration on the basis of doubtful constitutionality, is that the NCOP is empowered to make and to propose amendments to that bill to bring it within the confines of constitutionality. The fact that there was a procedural aspect relating to non-consultation opens the entire bill for amendment. But allow me to say that we've lost already, I think it's about 4 or 5 years with this bill in progress. The uncertainty is not in the best interest of our industry. We need to bring certainty. But I don't think we must bring certainty and in that process create more uncertainty. So I'm not suggesting we should hold back further. I think we should implement the bill, but I think we should amend it. And the easiest way to amend it to achieve that objective is to delete clauses 5, 8, and 21. It would, you know, Madam Chairperson, the balance of the provisions, while not ideal, can be implemented. And I think that's what the entire industry would want, is to implement those provisions, particularly from a mine, from an oil and gas perspective. But these three problematic provisions, I think, should be deleted. That is my recommendation, and I'm now going to hand back to McKingston to address you on the oil and gas provisions. Thank you very much.
Unfortunately, your time is I can only make a provision for members to ask for clarity seeking questions. We've agreed on 30 minutes. Any questions, members?
Oh.
Okay, if they don't have questions, then I can be lenient to you and give you a 5 minutes time to wrap up. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam.
Thank you. I'll just speak very briefly to the concerns in the context of the upstream petroleum industry. I should start off, first of all, by expressing the view that that many provisions in Chapter 6, which is the part of the bill that deals with the upstream oil and gas matters, have been significantly improved since the original bill was published for comment in 2012. So thank you for that. The concerns relating to Chapter 3 fall into three broad categories. The first pertains to free carried interest, the definition and consequences of that, the issue of a state option to acquire further rights, and the third is the dismantling of the Petroleum Agency of South Africa. So in the context of free carried interest, under Section 86A, the state has the automatic right to acquire a 20% free carried interest in all new exploration and production rights, and this includes production rights derived from existing exploration rights. In this regard, we would like to suggest that we align ourselves with international best practice, which is clear that the state, where the state participates in exploration and production rights, that they do it in the context of holding a carried interest in exploration and production rights, which is generally limited to between 10 and 20%. So the difference between a carried interest and a free carried interest is that all the exploration costs are borne by the non-state holder, but that these costs are subsequently recovered at the point of production. So while the state in this case would have between 10 and 20% of the rights, of the exploration rights, the cost of exploration would be refunded to the non-stakeholder at the time that production starts. The second issue pertains to the state option. The newly inserted Section 86A provides that in addition to the free carried interest, the state may acquire a further unlimited participating interest at an agreed price. This is the state option, or in the form of production sharing agreements. To this, again, we say that this is not necessarily aligned with international best practice and leads to a great level of uncertainty and discomfort. And what we're proposing here is that in the first instance, whenever the non-stakeholder sells an existing and pending application or expiration right, then the state has a preemptive right to acquire that interest. And anything applied for post the implementation of the MPRDA bill is still subject to this 20% cap carried interest, plus an additional participating interest of up to 30%, which may take the form of a carried interest or acquisition at an agreed price and or a production sharing agreement. We believe that that is a far more commercially accepted way of approaching the issue of the state option. And lastly, in the context of dismantling the Petroleum Agency of South Africa, we believe that the proposal around dismantling PASA is driven by the fact that PASA was constituted as a subsidiary of the Central Energy Fund when the Department of Energy and Mineral Resources functioned together as the Department of Mineral and Energy. Subsequent to splitting these departments into two, it would appear that the DMR's view is that the PASA function would need to be brought under the auspices of the DMR. We are suggesting that given how effective PASA have been over the years, that to the extent that it remains the steward of upstream legislation and regulation, we propose the creation of two new regional managers, given the fact that there's silence around how this would function in the current bill. And these two regional managers would be for the upstream offshore petroleum industry, and secondly, for the upstream onshore petroleum industry, given the fact that each of these industries is unique and would require, would need a specialist application, so to speak. Alternatively, which is probably the best course of action, we believe that it is worth considering PASA simply remaining as is, with the status quo being preserved. In the context of our proposal around the way forward, as you can see from the deliberations this afternoon, the MPRDA really focuses on mining. Oil and gas, upstream oil and gas in particular, is something that was an afterthought. In all the legislation that pertains to upstream petroleum issues, there hasn't been sufficient thought around what needs to happen in terms of a legislative framework that will encourage and incentivize investors to come and invest in South Africa. This in particular, taking into account the fact that if you look at other frontier jurisdictions such as Tanzania and Mozambique, these countries might have started far behind us in terms of putting in place the relevant and legislation around petroleum-related matters from an upstream perspective, but they certainly have overtaken us in the last 4 years as we waited for this particular bill or a bill of this nature to be passed. Ideally, we propose that, in fact, the issues pertaining to upstream petroleum should in fact be separated into a completely separate piece of legislation. And we think that this would take between 18 months and 24 months to process. But in the interim, we are also mindful of the fact that this is a dynamic environment in which we find ourselves, and we are very keen to see some sort of legislation be put in place that will enable, in the immediate term, that will enable your multinationals to come to South Africa and to invest their money rather than them investing elsewhere where there is greater certainty. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I've been seriously lenient. I've even exceeded by 5 minutes, but I didn't want to cut you off. Now we will be having our Center for Applied Legal Studies, and immediately after that we'll be having a 5 minute break.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and thank you for the opportunity. Amazing that the NGOs get cut off right in the beginning. And now we are lenient with the Chamber and Web Oriental. Center for Applied Legal Studies welcomes the opportunity. Thank you very much. My name is Louis Snyman. I'm an attorney there. This is Robert Krauss, a legal researcher, and Tandeka Kati, our candidate attorney. We focus primarily, we're at the University of Witwatersrand in the law school, and as a center we focus primarily on the participation in the minerals regime, mine closure, and what we're going to focus on today is the social labor plan system. As you'll see in the MPRDA bill summary, it makes specific reference to the SLP system and the provisions connected to that. Very little has been said about that today, and it's incredibly important that we talk about the social benefit system in mine affected areas. So we're going to speak very briefly about the procedural irregularity, because that's been covered substantially so far, and then look at the social benefit mechanisms in the MPRDA. First of all, you'll see in our submission that we formally endorse the submissions of both the Legal Resources Center and the Center for Environmental Rights as well, and don't feel that we have to duplicate those exactly.
There is an order here.
Yeah.
Our stakeholders, they don't debate presentation of another stakeholder.
Sure.
You just focus on your own, please.
Yes.
Thank you.
Just an endorsement. Thank you. very true. Thank you for catching me there. So then, in terms of the Berea Declaration and the People's Mining Charter, I think it sets out a nice framework for a base of which we think is a starting point for the inclusion in the MPRDA bill. We think that the community decision-making through negotiation, giving reference to free and prior informed consent, is a good starting point in terms of democratic community decision-making and not focusing primarily on traditional authority decision-making. True community decision-making must be recognized. The equity of benefits, the benefits shared equally, specifically amongst workers and community members. We've been hearing calls constantly over the past 4.5 years from our community partners in relation to independent, accessible recourse mechanisms. These need to be given priority because people's frustrations are boiling over. There needs to be given a recognition of a failure of accountability, and we need to make provision for those. Rehabilitation standards, we understand that it is very difficult to return the land as to what it was before mining because it is such an invasive activity, but there needs to be proper rehabilitation standards that communities can use the land after mining. In terms of restitution and reparations, the legacy of mining in South Africa has been one based in an oppressive system, and this needs to be recognized in terms of restitution and reparations in mining areas. And then in terms of compensation, we've all heard from the community members regarding the loss of livelihoods, the loss of arable land, the loss of land for agriculture, and the harms to the environment and the culture. This needs to be compensated properly. And lastly, we see the empowerment and respect and inclusion of women not only in this particular process, but in the initiatives that are put forward by mining industries. Going into the next slide, which is the legality of the amendments, a lot has been said and previously about this, so I'd just like to take us back to the first day in which we heard this about this bill. It was the 27th of December, 2012. Our organization wasn't even open, and yet we have to comment on bills of such complexity, but it's right before, it's right in the area where we think that people will not respond. I think that is damaging towards public participation and the sentiment and sends the message. So I think that needs to be recognized. And until now, I mean, we've talked about, and we understand, Madam Chair, about the provincial hearings and the control that you have regarding that. We respect that, but we'd like to say again, notice periods for oral hearings, opportunities for written submissions. These have to be practical. We cannot expect people and community members to grasp a bill of this nature within 5 days. Transport has to be organized. All kinds of logistical arrangements have to be organized. We cannot expect this. We have been busy with this, and this has been busy now on and off for 4.5 years. Yet not one of our comments have been included. Are they that bad? Are we suffering from poor comments here? Because, and other civil society members have also not been included. So I'm asking, why do we continue to submit comments if we are not being included in the draft bills? And if we are not, what are the reasons for that? You know, so it's just it's a frustrating process, and it's been a long process, and I know everybody has got frustrations in this process, but let's give each other the opportunity to try and influence where we think it's fit. In terms of the new amendments, we call again for the fact that this is highly irregular and falls outside of the mandate and the referral mandate by the President. It's something that we think, and the reason why we mention this, and the reason why a lot of people have been mentioning this, that it could prove a fatal flaw, which could further delay this process. And if subject to a court challenge or review, there could be further delays in this process. So I think the members should be aware of the possibility of this eventuality. I'm going to hand over briefly to my colleague Robert, just to talk briefly about the redress and distributive issues, which he'll weave into to the beginnings of the comments.
Thank you, honourable members. So a significant portion of Kelser's comments on both the bill that was referred back by the President and previous iterations of the bill have focused on what the bill does, or more actually accurately, what the bill doesn't do in relation to social neighbour plans. As some of you might be aware, in reaction to the horrific Marikana massacre, Centre for Applied Legal Studies and the Marikana Commission of Inquiry found that one of the contributing factors to the atmosphere of tension was the failure of Lonmin to comply with its obligation to build 5,500 houses. And so Kells was concerned that, and also based on further reports that we'd received from community partners, that this was a systemic trend. So we wanted to investigate that further to see whether that was correct and gather more evidence in that regard. So we started a three-year project cycle on social labor plans, and I'll very briefly talk about the three. So the first was examining a sample of 50 social labor plans and analyzing their quality and ability to meet their objectives. The second was engaging in interviewing the multiple stakeholders in the sector, and including communities in community members in five different mining areas in the country, on how the system operated in practice and what were the problems. And I mean the most, and then the final phase that we're currently in is focused on the way forward, on what kinds of changes to the existing social labor plan system would make it more fit to purpose, but also proposing ideas for possibly a fundamentally better system as well. So one of the failures of the social labor plan system, and which has been repeatedly emphasized in our comments, is the failure to specify, even to expressly require, in binding legislation, participation by community members or the broader community. So, and so the most we have currently, as it stands, are in advisory guidelines, the 2010 SLP guidelines, where in relation to the local economic development section of SLPs, there's reference to that in consultation with communities, that's the phrase, but nothing is specified of what that actually means. And there are a number of requirements that we've stated are absolutely vital to robust participation. And I think one of them has been discussed a lot today, not in relation to social labor plans, but in relation to this legislative process, and that is proper notice in a form that is accessible to the beneficiary communities and workers that these plans are meant to belong to. So things like the language of the notice, the fora, is it on where not everybody is literate? Is it on community radio stations or at announced at community embassies? I think there should be a lot more guidance on that. Then the fact that consultation this is not enough to consult solely with traditional leaders, but especially in areas where the legitimacy of leadership is contested. But the legislation needs to be very clear that that does not tick the box doing so. Another important aspect, and I think it's a call increasingly coming from community members but and organizations, from civil society organizations, is the need to ensure that, firstly, as we've said, there needs to be a process for participation, but for that process to be meaningful, communities should have the same access to, should have access to specialists in local economic development planning, economics, project management, the same kinds of specialists that mining companies have access to. And there needs to be, we need to think about a fund that would ensure that communities are able to choose experts, that they because a meaningful negotiation, and if we go back to the transformative aims of the Act in the first place, it's to fundamentally change historical power relations in the sector. And to do that meaningfully, there needs to be an equality of arms. People should have equality of information and equal access to expertise. And the last point I make is, and what the bill does not, what does not do, is address the question of access to information, by which I mean specifying in no uncertain terms that, firstly, a component is in principle, specifying in no uncertain terms that social narrow plans and the annual compliance reports submitted by the rights holder pursuant to them are public documents to which anybody, no exceptions, no interest in affected parties, this or that, everybody is entitled. But furthermore, that's not enough. What also needs to be required is that they be meaningful, just like with meaningful notice for participation of the actual documents, there needs to be meaningful dissemination in languages that communities speak, at fora that they speak, as well as the internet, but cannot only be the internet, which many communities don't have access to. And just to kind of illustrate what it's like in reality accessing SRPs, what is actually entailed, in practice, with exceptions of a small number of companies that provide these documents online, which is also a limited, many community members can't access. But in many cases, the standard approach is still to, in practice, to get them through the Department of Mineral Resources via an access to information request in terms of PIA. Briefly, what does that entail for us? And remember, we are relatively well-resourced civil society organization with time. It's our work time to do that. I mean, other people are working in other jobs, don't have time for this. So what you have to do is, first you have to actually go physically. The DMR prefers us to go physically to Pretoria to lodge their specific version of the Form A PIA request. And obviously with a request fee, that can be another barrier. So in many cases, we know where mining is, and in many cases that is not at all near Pretoria. Second, though these days, usually access is granted, but in terms of actually arranging access, requesters are required to engage with the regions of the DMR where SLPs are held and lodged, or held. So that, what that actually means is, in practice, and every single time it happens like that, where you chase them, you chase officials, you make, I don't know how many, like, I record every time there's a telephone call. It's like 5, 6, 7 telephone calls till there's actually clarity on the time and on the fee. And then, again, you have to go all the way to the DMR region. Plus, you have to obviously pay an access fee, which for many communities is debilitating, especially communities near multiple mines where there might be multiple social airplanes, annual reports. That can easily come into the hundreds or more. I'll hand over to my colleague again.
So, what picture is this painting? Is this particular benefit system an inclusive one? Is this one that benefits the primary beneficiaries, the people that are impacted? No, it is not. And it makes for a very difficult relationship, and one that we're seeing spilling over, and one that we're seeing getting more and more aggressive. And there needs to be trust between parties, and that starts with transparency and access to information. No more secrets. Why are these so confidential if you've got nothing to hide? So, what does this mean in practice? So, for us, I think there are a lot of reasons. We've written two reports. You're welcome to those. But the DMR, in our opinion, is failing to protect community interests, both in the licensing process, but also in compliance and monitoring, not only of SLPs, but a variety of other licenses. The research that we've done over the last few years really, very, very rarely have community members actually met anybody from the department. What does that mean? It means that the state of the custodian of the minerals to benefit people actually has absolutely no contact with the people that they're supposed to benefit. They're dealing with mining companies, they're dealing with consultants. What we are calling for is visibility of DMR officials on the ground at public participation meetings. Someone that can be held accountable. Someone that you can go to. That's why people are banging down the doors of the mining companies, the local municipalities, because that's the only place they know where to go. People are bust in sometimes to the Pretoria office of DMR. That's the only recourse that they think they have. Where is the responsiveness? So we're calling for that. We're calling for officials to be at meetings, to be all the stakeholders, to be a face of the state in the mining area. In terms of the amendment process, this is a specific area of contention that I think is a legal loophole, where social and labour plans can be amended by consent of the minister directly with absolutely no public participation. What this actually means is that SLPs become diluted over the five-year cycle without anybody knowing what the actual target becomes. We need to have provisions that relate to the nature and extent of amendments, how people can get involved in these amendments, the legal effect of these amendments, what happens to the previous amendments. You can sit with an SLP in year one, and targets in year five can be completely different. 5,500 houses can be 500 houses. Yet people are still expecting 5,500, but it's legally binding. So that is a loophole that we need to close. So if you think about it, SLPs running in these five-year cycles, every 5 years you have new obligations. What happens if you don't fulfill your old obligations? Do they run in parallel with your new obligations, or are those extinguished? It's like kicking the can down the road. You constantly have goalposts being changed without fulfilling targets. We need clarity on that. The bill proposes this review process in terms of SLPs. But what does this review process actually entail? How are people meant to be involved in these review processes? You cannot get an accurate picture whether an SLP is responding to community needs without looking at how it has been performing over the last 5 years, and then that information feeding into the next 5 years. And yet, without getting the beneficiary's input on that, how are you actually making that judgment call? Is it someone in Pretoria making that judgment call? Is it someone at regional office level making that judgment call? So that review process really needs to be clarified for us. Lastly, because we stick to our time here, in terms of the social and labour plan financial provision, we are seeing times when the SLP provision is being diluted because of market conditions, company liquidity, and a dropping of commodity price. Yet, in that same process, the impact persists. The impact is still the same, but the benefit is diluted. Now, why is that? It's because the SLP provision itself is not ring-fenced. It's my company is not doing well. Let's dig into that. We need to have clarity on that, and it needs to be. I can give you upwards of 15 SLPs that I've seen that on the last page give it a caveat. There's a caveat that says, subject to a specific commodity price, if the commodity price falls under this level, the rights holder reserves the right to alter the obligations in the SLP. What does that mean? That's a direct out. That means the gold price is doing badly, I no longer have to build these houses. yet the impact persists. And people are not part of this decision. So you have situations where it's either very cleverly crafted or it's an omission. I'd like to think it's an omission that we can attend to. What we're proposing, we understand that the mining industry is cyclical in nature. It has peaks and troughs. When we are in a peak, we must recognize that the going is good, and we must put aside money into a fund that when we are in the bad, we understand that money can still be channeled to community benefit. A rainy day fund, if you wish. Yet, we throw up our hands and say we cannot. We cannot because we don't have the money. Plan. You know you're not going to have the money in the future. So, what we are saying is we need to prioritize community interests. I think the bill recognizes that we need to do that, but doesn't go far enough to do that. There's a fantastic opportunity here to put these voices forward. You've heard from a variety of different organizations about what that means. I think the process up till now has not been sufficient in order to get that picture. That's all from us. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for the presentation. Straightforward to the point. Can I then allow the members for question of clarification? Before that, let me welcome Honorable Dami. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you very much. Thanks, sir. In your presentation, you highlighted that you need the bill to address the issue of community having access to specialties. Now, I want to check with you as to how do you exactly want the bill to address the matter, so that when we engage, we are sure of your opinion, because now it's just a vague sentence. Sure.
What is now? No other hand. All right.
Thank you very much, and a good question, because I think the devil is in the detail here. So, in terms of community expertise, we think that either from the state or the company side, there should be a fund established that community members can select their own experts, and I think these specific experts should be in a range of different expertise. What we are saying is that we need experts in order to explain the ramifications of the reports that come out of the licensing process, explain how mining is going to impact people's lives, and then allow the communities to discuss those impacts so that they can meaningfully participate. Because at the moment, and I've been to these meetings, you have a public participation meeting where you have a projector, 400 people, and people speaking in English. How can people meaningfully participate in a public participation process and then an EIA document on your lap of 450 pages with graphs and specialist input? Now, I might be pushing this to prove a point, but you see the picture I'm trying to paint is there needs to be, as my colleague said, equality of arms in understanding the impacts of mining, especially in areas that haven't had mining before. So, You need to create a real-world picture, because what's happening now is companies come, they promise the world, they promise jobs, they promise socio-economic development, and then we are actually seeing a decline in the wealth and access of services to communities. And there's been reports by ActionAid about this. So people need to understand impact, and I think through an expertise fund, they can be allowed to do this.
Yeah. Thank you very much. No, you are on point, but the time is up. Yes, ma'am.
Maybe I didn't get it, Chair. My apologies if I've off-framed. Maybe I didn't get it. He's saying there must be a fund establishment. I get it, we are dealing with the bill here. If there is a fund establishment, who exactly must fund? it must be, I don't know, can he explain to us who exactly must fund? Is it the companies or the state?
Well, I can already hear murmurs from the company going, not us again. But here, I think also the state has a responsibility to make sure that the public participation process is meaningful. So I think either collaboration or state responsibility. But we need to have a situation where we change the way we engage with people who are directly impacted. And that comes with understanding the impacts. That was the point that was made, and the point about expertise was an option on the table. Thank you.
Now we will be breaking for 5 minutes and come back and take the National Union of Mine with us.